of this discussion is not at the level of promoting a tradition of Ghadir or promoting the tradition of those who are the Tashayyu, who are the Shia, or to promote the idea of one school of thought among thousands. It's not. It is to establish and fundamentally be the leading group that puts forth an argument that states that those personalities whom you have chosen out there in this world of religions, if they can compare to this, then we are on equal terms. But what is this that we're talking about? It is a kind of a quality that is dormant, it is in all our hearts, that we pass judgment on no matter what we do in life. We sacrifice what? We sacrificed by avoiding evil and promoting good. We sacrifice our evil inclinations for the good. We sacrificed the love of this world, which could be destructive, for the love of this world and the hereafter, which is productive and progressive. That kind of a sacrifice, Allah says, celebrate. That is why we celebrate.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. As the Zionist entity continues waging its campaign of terror and genocide against the people of Palestine, there are many who make the mistake of thinking that only the Muslims of Palestine face the tyranny of the Zionist regime. On this week's show, we look at the plight faced by the Christians of Palestine at the hands of both the Zionist state and the extremist Jewish settlers living on stolen Palestinian land. And we begin by analysing exactly why Palestine and Jerusalem in particular are so important to adherents of the Christian religion.
December is the time of year that Christians worldwide celebrate the birth of the Messiah, Jesus, may peace and blessings be upon him. Celebrations in Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus, are considered holy because the passion and resurrection of Jesus happened inside the city's walls. Bethlehem is a Palestinian city in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, surrounded today by a massive concrete wall, military checkpoints, and illegal settlements.
It's imposing a system of control that I'm sure Jesus was very familiar of. If he's born today, he would be born on our side of the wall.
According to the Gospels, the most important features of Christianity have their origins in Jerusalem. the institution of the Eucharist took place while Jesus was celebrating Passover with his disciples in Jerusalem. Also, his crucifixion at the Golgotha, where Jesus remained calm, compassionate, and loving even in the face of death. And according to Christian belief, his resurrection 3 days later all happened in Jerusalem. In this way, Jerusalem constitutes a unique and holy city for Christianity. Other holy sites are associated with events from the Old Testament, the lives of Mary, John the Baptist, and the Apostles, with endless more associated with later Christian saints, holy men and women, and local traditions. But Bethlehem will be a somber place this year, as the Christian of the three major churches, Greek Orthodox, Armenian, and Catholic, have stated they will not be celebrating.
This year is going to be totally different. There won't be any lights. We will not have the Christmas tree. We will be mourning those who are being slaughtered in Gaza. There's a deep atmosphere of grief here, and all the churches have decided to only have religious services for Christmas.
These holy places, the indigenous Christian community and pilgrims who come to visit from all over the world, have long been the subject of violence, harassment, and intimidation by the occupation forces who have not allowed the community to worship in peace. The Temple Mount is no exception, often the subject of brutality despite being considered a holy place. It is where Jesus was first presented as an infant to the temple and its people by his holy mother Maria. It was also there where he famously taught elders of the community at the tender age of 13 and later threw out the money changers from the same temple grounds. Unfortunately, the percentage of Christians living in Bethlehem and in other occupied Palestinian territories has plummeted. With the community currently totaling under 2% of the population, the fear that Christians will one day no longer have a presence in Palestine is slowly becoming a reality. The reason is extremely clear for the indigenous worshippers.
Joining us on the show this week to discuss this important topic are two special guests. Joining us in the studio is Amir Aqil, who is a board member of Palestine Pulse, a London-based group on the path to creating a new movement led by the grandchildren of the Nakba and like-minded peers, amplifying the Palestinian liberation movement through British-based voices. And we are also extremely honoured to be joined by Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer, the founder and director of Peacemaker Trust, a UK charity dedicated to peacemaking, especially where minorities are persecuted and where human rights are suppressed. Reverend Dr. Stephen is also the director of the Institute of the Study of Christian Zionism and a member of the executive of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He is a retired Anglican priest, but continues to serve as chaplain to the former Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop Riyah Abul Asal. Reverend, if I can come to you, please, first. Thank you again for joining us. Why do Christians have such an affinity with Palestine and Jerusalem?
We have a strong affinity for Palestine in particular because it's the location of where God's redemptive plan was achieved in and through the Lord Jesus. He was born in Bethlehem. He lived much of his life in the Galilee, and he was arrested, crucified, and rose again in Jerusalem. So the central tenets of the historic life and teaching of Jesus revolve around Palestine. And not surprisingly, it was where the church was founded among his followers. And so the Palestinian Christian community represents the indigenous mother church, if you like, for the global church today.
Thank you for that. I know it seemed like such an obvious question, but, you know, I feel like the Christian community often don't speak enough about the relevance of Palestine. And Amira, yourself, who has lived as a Palestinian, lived in her homeland and have been given the privilege of traveling extensively because you are British, obviously it's a privilege that other Palestinians don't have. Let me ask you about what you've seen in your time in Palestine, about the oppression of the indigenous Christian community there at the hands of the occupation and extremist settlers.
Yes, so the way that we see it as Palestinians is Palestine operates as a community, and that's regardless of religion. But what I've seen personally living there is that Palestinians, Christians, Muslims, they they face oppression on a daily basis, and it's the same oppression. The Christians don't get spoken about enough, which I think is tactical, but they go through the same land grabs, settler violence on a daily basis, streets they're not allowed to walk down just because they're Palestinian, regardless of their religion, facing the IOF on a daily basis, their children also getting imprisoned and arrested for false trumped-up charges, apart from the fact that, you know, Palestinians in the West Bank also get killed quite frequently, regardless, again, of religion. The Zionists can't tell what religion you are by looking at you, and so, therefore, the Christians are persecuted the same way as any other Palestinian, hence why we say that we're a community made up of different religions. It's a lack of freedom of movement for the Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians. It's a lack of religious right to practice your religion, whether going to churches or mosques. It's the same persecution that they face. I think the issue that we have is that the Christians don't get spoken about a lot because of the fact that it goes against Israel's agenda of making this a Muslim Jewish issue, where actually it's a Palestinian against Israel issue, regardless, again, of religion. So, like I said, we are one community and we act in that way. And the Palestinian Christians and Muslims go through the same thing.
It's definitely something that we've seen, the unity between the Christians and the Palestinians, you know, on footage that has gone viral, but also in cases like Shireen Abu Akleh, who, you know, is one of our most beloved and treasured heroines of the Palestinian liberation, doing her job and obviously attacked in cold blood and murdered by the entity. But also something that you said that was really striking to me is I found myself surprised to hear of, although I've seen it, and as a Palestinian I've grown up seeing it, I was still surprised to hear just how much repression the Christian community is suffering. And that's upsetting. It's almost like this, you know, internalized colonization that I'm fighting. Reverend, if I can come to you for this question, as a religious leader, I'm sure that you have seen and heard these things that we've just spoken about, what Amira has attested to. But, you know, we know that scholars of all Abrahamic faiths have long been the targets of pro-apartheid lobbies who have launched heavy campaigns to have them displaced from their roles if they speak about Palestine. Can you tell us about why religious leaders are targets? And if you have any experience in this matter, set the scene for us.
Well, Israel is an apartheid state. It's based on supremacism. It's a racist endeavor. And it's a settler colonial enterprise. And that's an indefensible political position. And therefore, it must make its critics, particularly those committed to human rights, it must make them appear worse to distract attention from its own crimes. So it accuses Jewish anti-Zionists, for example, as Jew haters, and it accuses non-Jews like me and others as either Holocaust deniers or anti-Semites. The way they've achieved this is by pushing a misdefinition of anti-Semitism. It's called the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, misdefinition. It's a working definition. It was never intended to be used in legal terms. But it essentially dilutes anti-Semitism from prejudice, hostility, racism towards Jews because they're Jews, but equates similar criticisms of Israel as anti-Semitism, which is entirely fallacious. It's untrue. But by imposing this new definition on particularly Western governments, churches, trade unions, universities, they have broadened out this definition. So if you criticize Israel, they'll accuse you of being anti-Semitic. In my own personal experience, I've faced 20 years or more of intimidation, where they target or critical of you, accusing you of associating with anti-Semites or Holocaust deniers and so on. One occasion, they accused me of seeking to divert church funds to Hamas in Gaza, which is entirely untrue. But they intimidate you, and if that doesn't work, they intimidate others to try and isolate you. So invitations to speak in universities or churches suddenly will be withdrawn because pressure has been put upon them not to have you speak. I encountered a complaint that was made about me in 2012 accusing me of anti-Semitism. That was resolved amicably, but then they had another go in 2018, and that led to a tribunal. It took 4 years. They couldn't find a single person to come and be a witness against me. I had 50 witnesses on my side, rabbis, academics, bishops. They couldn't find a single word of mine that was deemed anti-Semitic, and yet the tribunal found me guilty of conduct unbecoming, gave me a 12-year suspension from being an Anglican priest, so much so that one Jewish academic, Jeff Halper, called it an inquisition, and the expert witness on anti-Semitism at my tribunal, Anthony Lerman, said it's an indelible stain on the Church of England to accuse someone who's never uttered a single word against the Jews to be accused of anti-Semitism. So that's how they do it. They target academics, they target politicians like Jeremy Corbyn and clergy. And if they get one scalp, one head, everyone else keeps their heads down. And that's part of their agenda, to silence criticism where really criticism needs to be directed at them.
What an interesting story, and something that I'm sure many other religious leaders have similar stories like yourself. What I'd like to do now is have us all take a look at some examples of how Christians and their beliefs are denigrated by the Zionist Jewish occupiers of Palestine.
The genocide against the Palestinian people has brought Judaism and Jewish extremism into the spotlight. From extremist rabbis calling for Christians to be killed,
2 billion Christians, which are idol worshippers, between Chinese, Indian, Hindus, Buddhists, and Christian, at least 6.5 billion people are idol worshippers that, according to the Torah, do not have the right to live. Idol worshiper goy, it's death penalty. Not only Jews, even a goy who bow down to an idol, who believe in JC, deserve death penalty.
In my country.
To ordinary Israelis making the same murderous threats.
Are you Jewish? Do you want to honor God? That is the godly thing to do. We respect one another.
The godly thing to do is to kill you.
The godly thing is to kill me.
That's right. That's what the Torah says.
The Torah says to kill us.
The Torah says that people who worship idols such as yourself, when there is a Sanhedrin,
to kill us.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what the Torah says.
So we know how the Jewish people feel about Christians, yes? That you discriminate against Christians.
Christians are idol worshippers.
You discriminate against Christians.
The Torah says that Christianity is idol worship.
You also have the same rabbis making threats to destroy churches.
Even if the United States government would say, okay, hey, you're becoming too fanatic, the government, too religious, we'll give you $1 billion extra every year to the aid, don't touch the churches. We're not allowed to listen to them. God comes before Obama and his friends.
While it appears that for the Jewish extremist squatters in Palestine, spitting on Christians is a favored pastime. Then there is the outright blasphemy against Jesus and his pure mother.
Reverend, if I can come to you again for this question, you know, what you've, the persecution that you've faced, I'm assuming, you know, is a parallel that you can draw between yourself, the Christian Palestinians, but also Jesus as well faced similar persecution by the people of his time. Can you give us some information on that and draw some parallels for us?
I'd be pleased to. The parallels are quite significant. The first century Judaism was under foreign military occupation, the Roman Empire, and the political and religious leaders, people like Herod, the king, and the Pharisees and Sadducees, the religious leaders, were cooperating with the Roman government and oppressing the people. They were used as a means of oppressing and taxing the people. And so the parallels with Zionism today, with supremacism, with antagonism toward the poor, the marginalized, and the foreigners, the parallels are clear. Jesus was a threat to that. Even before he was born, his mother, Mary, when she was told that she was expecting him, it's called Mary's Song. She speaks about how he will bring down the rulers from their thrones. He will lift up the humble. He will fill the hungry with good things and send the rich away empty. After Jesus was born, King Herod recognized there was a threat when the Magi from Iran visited Bethlehem to worship Jesus and give him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Herod instituted a pogrom to try and have Jesus murdered as a baby. He had orders given to kill all the boys in Bethlehem under the age of two because he saw Jesus as a threat. As an adult, Jesus' very first sermon given in Nazareth speaks of how he would proclaim freedom for prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, set the oppressed free, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. The year of the Lord's favor was a jubilee, the time when slaves would be freed, when debts would be canceled, and that was what he was coming to do, to bring a revolution to the status quo. He anticipated persecution in his Sermon on the Mount, probably his most famous sermon. He says, "You'll be blessed if you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets." As we follow through the life of Jesus as an adult, we see him challenging the religious leaders, challenging the status quo, the foreign rulers, turning the tables in the temple, casting out those who were exploiting the poor. And on one occasion, they tried to trap Jesus, and they said, "Should we pay taxes to Caesar?" And Jesus said, "Show me a coin." And they gave him a coin, and he said, "Whose image is on the coin?" And they all shouted out, "Caesar's." He said, "Well, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's." He was pointing out that they were using this money. Therefore, they were already compromising with the government, the Roman government. Yes, pay your taxes, but remember your responsibility is ultimate to God, and he is sovereign. At his trial, Pilate challenged Jesus and said, "Don't you realize I can have you killed?" And Jesus said, "You would have no authority were it not given you from God himself. God is sovereign. God is in control." All through the life of Jesus, we see how he antagonized and challenged those who were committed to a supremacism, committed to the status quo, using their power to exploit particularly the vulnerable.
And everything that you've just said about, Jesus, may peace and blessings be upon him, and his his fight and his resilience in fighting his oppressors is actually something that we've all seen of the Palestinians currently, whether it be Christian, Muslim, or even our Jewish Palestinian community, fighting the IOF and, you know, doing so with so much dignity and so much honor. You know, Amira, if I can come back to you, footage that we've, you know, seen of Christians in Palestine being insulted and being spat on, etc., by the community. It's gone viral. It's not new. Yet they are, as a community, you know, Israel kind of, what it does is that it propagates itself as this, the only democracy in the Middle East where everyone has their freedoms, whether it be in the religious sector or in the personal sector. What do settlers and their patrons in the Israeli regime really think about Christians, you know, from your own experience, from what you've seen?
To sum it up, I think an unwanted nuisance, because if it, it again goes against their agenda, having Christians in Palestine, where they want to, you know, make it very obvious that it's a Muslim problem, and having the Christians there is an issue, which is one of the reasons why systematically they've been pushed out, whether that be in Jerusalem or West Bank, and the population is dwindling. So if we look at, for example, in 1922, there was 10% population, a Christian population in the whole of the land, whereas now it's estimated 2% in the whole of the land. And these people aren't running away from their Palestinian brothers and sisters, but regardless of religion. They're running away from being systematically attacked by the settlers, by the regime in general, whether that's persecution, whether that's, you know, not allowing them to practice their religion, and constantly taking from them, whether it, you know, their lands, their homes. They face the same things on a daily basis as the Muslims. So I think how they see, how settlers and the regime sees them is a population in Palestine that needs to go. It needs to be pushed into Jordan. It needs to be pushed into other surrounding countries because that fits their agenda. And we've seen it. We've seen their percentage. I mean, they weren't too many to begin with. And, you know, we have to remember, these are the most ancient Christians in the world that we have in Palestine. And they need to be respected and looked after because at the moment they are facing a real threat of extinction.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if we don't look after them and show the Western world what's happening to them, in the next 20, 30 years, we do face, we face the fact that there might not be any ancient Christians that are related to the past biblical stories on the land that Jesus was born in.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's definitely something that the Muslim community in Palestine feel very strong about. Yeah. It's, you know, there has been conversations back and forth of if our mosques are bombed, you know, Christian priests have said that we will make the call for Adhan and we will be the ones to honour Islamic prayer for the community. And the same, and the inverse is true, whereas the Muslims have said if no churches exist, you know, we will make sure to honour the traditions of Christianity in the land. Reverend, thank you so much for joining us. And the same for you, Amira. This is such an enlightened conversation, and I wish that we had more time to continue it. But unfortunately, that is all that we have time for today. Thank you at home, and join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Al-Aqsa storm operation has irreversibly redefined the battlefield dynamics, especially with the Palestinian resistance stunning the military pundits in the West with its preparedness and the ability to inflict heavy and irreparable blows to the occupying Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted the past 15 weeks have been marked by the Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime genocidal aggression on the Gaza Strip, with the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance group Hamas surprising all and sundry with its massive weapons arsenal, all of them locally manufactured. Toward the end of 2023, the martyr Izzeddin Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, published a video showing its missile arsenal that is able to reach every nook and corner of the occupied territories. Military experts in the West acknowledge that the Israeli regime, with all its advanced and sophisticated weapon systems imported from the United States and Europe, has been unable to match up to the armed wings of the Palestinian resistance groups and their fighters. Despite the Zionist regime dropping 67,000 tons of bombs on Gaza since October 7th, the resistance continues to grow and inflict heavy blows on the structure of the Zionist occupation. The story of the Palestinian missile program is a story of decades of sacrifice, ingenuity, dedicated work, and successful management, and above all, the defiant spirit of resistance. This long and difficult path of resistance against the apartheid regime began with Palestinian stone throwing at Israeli armored vehicles during two intifadas, and ended with the capability to launch 5,000 rockets in one day and a rocket arsenal sufficient for months of warfare. The missile capabilities and scope of operations displayed by the Hamas and other Palestinian groups surprised all international observers, even the Zionist intelligence services. What is particularly intriguing are the conditions in which the operation was carried out. Pertinently, the Gaza Strip was under Israeli occupation from 1967 to 2005, and ever since has been under a fierce land, sea, and air blockade that prevents the import of not only weapons, but also materials for their production as well as basic goods. The Zionist regime tried everything to weaken the resistance and retain the military technological advantage so that it could easily eliminate the groups that have been fighting for the liberation of Palestine. An example that illustrates this disparity is the Gaza massacre of 15 years ago, when hundreds of Palestinian civilians were killed by the Zionist regime's bombs. Hundreds of Israeli civilians, the so-called war tourists, gathered on the nearby hills and cheered triumphantly. However, times have changed since that gruesome bloodthirsty cheering by the Zionist settlers that was followed by the iconic photo of a Palestinian boy throwing a rock at an Israeli tank. The Palestinian resistance initially relied on rudimentary weapons, smuggled or domestically produced, intended for close combat and countering invading forces on their soil. After years of usage of assault rifles and explosives, a simple Qassam rocket appeared in 2001, with a range of a handful of kilometers and low destructive power, which for the first time made possible a retaliatory strike against the Israeli occupation. Over time, the efficiency of the Qassam models increased, and the first Israeli military bases and occupied cities came within range in 2010s, which caused the phenomenon of war tourists on the borders of Gaza to fall into oblivion suddenly. The Zionist regime made an effort to stop the effectiveness of these rocket attacks by developing a warning system. It invested a staggering amount of money in the development of Iron Dome, a military system that turned out to be a miserable failure on October 7th. It also boasted about assassinating the Hamas rocket engineers responsible for the Qassam development, thinking it might cripple the Palestinian brain trust or deter new generations from engaging in development, which proved to be a blowback assessment. Today, the Palestinian resistance has rockets with a range of hundreds of kilometers and warheads with a payload of hundreds of kilograms, capable of reaching any point in the occupied Palestinian territories called Israel. Due to their size, it is not possible to smuggle these rockets from abroad into the Gaza Strip, especially not in such huge quantities, which proves that they are the result of local production, industrial production, in conditions of a scarcity of necessary materials and exposure to the Zionist regime's airstrikes is an impressive feat in itself. Production facilities are scattered underground and well hidden, which requires exceptional logistical skills. The same applies to the supply of materials, which mainly comes from recycling raw materials such as old water pipes, anchors of destroyed buildings, streetlight poles, and so on. In an astonishing feat from 2020, Hamas naval commandos managed to salvage large 170-kilogram naval shells from a British warship that sunk offshore more than 100 years ago during the First World War and made them reusable for new missiles. The rocket engines and guidance systems are the product of cooperation and military knowledge imparted by experts in the region, especially Iran. The missiles revealed in the new video include the Maqadma and Jabari rocket family, both with a range of 90 kilometers and 50 kilogram warheads put into service in early 2010s. Development in the middle of the same decade witnessed the creation of the Attar rocket family with a range of 90 kilometers and 50 kilograms warhead, as well as the Rantisi rocket family with a range of 170 kilometers and 100 kilogram warhead. Firstly, at the end of 2010s, the Ayash rocket family was put into service with a range of 250 kilometers and a payload of 250 kilograms, the most powerful rocket in the Palestinian arsenal, used for strikes on Safed and Eilat during the Al-Aqsa flood operation. At the same time, the Sejil rocket family with a range of 55 kilometers and 50 kilogram warhead was also introduced, followed by the Shamala rocket family with a range of 80 kilometers and 150 kilogram warhead. Except for the Sejil rocket series, which is named after a Quranic verse, all others are named after Palestinian martyrs, namely Ibrahim al-Maqadma, Ahmad al-Jabari, Raed al-Attar, Abdulaziz al-Rantisi, Muhammad Abu Shamala, and Yahya Ayash. For three decades, the Zionist regime thought that these assassinations would break the spirit of resistance and their technological development, which backfired in a way it could not have imagined. The martyrs and the missiles named after them are today giving sleepless nights to the child killer regime of Israel.
Beep.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytani rajim and bismillahir rahmanir rahim. A warm greeting to you, brothers and sisters of faith, wherever you may be in the world. Welcome to another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to mention a lot of the questions that you, dear parents, Muslim parents, might have with regards to your teenage children. In the studio, we have Sayyid Salman Naqawi, our expert of the program Islamic Upbringing, who is the faculty member of Islamic Studies in Al-Mustafa International University. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. And we've been talking about the two styles of parenting, namely transformational and transactional parenting. We talked about transformational parenting, 12 the qualities which are empowerment and autonomy. Inshallah, in this program, we will mention two other qualities of transformational parenting. Sayyid, we are all ears.
So, thank you very much. Let's continue with the attributes and qualities of a transformational parent. He, as we said, he empowers his child. He brings out the best in him, instills in him self-esteem, autonomy, confidence, and as a result, the child becomes competent to do things which are appropriate in the best possible way. And then, how does he deal with the differences of opinion that are there? He imposes, as in the transactional way, it was that he would say, okay, this is my command, you have to do it.
Right.
Even if I listen to you, you have to do it my way. But here, we want the child to do the right thing in the right way, but we need to discuss with him.
Even if it takes a really longer time.
اُدُعُ إِلَىٰ سَبِيلِ رَبِّكَ بِالْحِكْمَةِ وَالْمَوْعِظَةِ الْحَسَنَةِ وَجَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنُ.
It's not for,
it doesn't mean you have to call unto to the way of Allah Almighty, the path of Allah.
With wisdom.
In a very good manner, you discuss things.
You don't impose it.
I mean, you are advising, counseling, asking him to do something in a very polite and respectful way.
Right, it's like a bilateral relationship.
Yes, a dialogue. It's talking, maybe we think that this holy verse is talking about non-believers.
Hmm.
No, even it's talking about believers, your children. You need to talk to them, talk. Wisdom. What is wisdom? What is hikmah? Hikmah means it's a level where you achieve that that state where you can think what is the best way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you talk about, for example, when we talk about wisdom and hikmah in the Quran, we see that Allah Almighty mentions Luqman.
Exactly.
That he gave him hikmah, wisdom, anishkur lillah. That he, with this wisdom, he is able to thank Allah Almighty.
Right. And this wisdom comes from pure worshipping of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, solely and purely for his sake. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, you brothers and sisters. Sayed beautifully mentioned the point that as parents, we shouldn't impose our ideas onto our children. And as the beautiful verse of the Quran says, try to talk to people with wisdom and ma'izat al-hasana, with a beautiful dialogue-ish way, not a monologue-ish way, right? And
وَجَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي أَحْسَنُ.
Right.
And argue with them in a very polite and a beautiful way.
The most beautiful
way. The most beautiful way. Hikmah is doing things in the beautiful way. Hikmah, anishkur lillah, is something which leads you to thank Allah. Thanking Allah is not by just saying shukran lillah or alhamdulillah. It's doing things in the proper way, using the bounties given to us by Allah Almighty, everything that has been given to us, all the resources which we have at our disposal have been given to us by Allah, using them in a proper way, in the proper, the best way, with ihsan, carrying out good deeds with our bodies, with our souls, with our minds, it is according to hikmah. And this leads us to thank Allah Almighty in a practical way. Thanking is not just saying.
Lip service.
It's not only thinking about the fact that we thank Allah, or it's not even feeling for Him. Doing things in the best possible way with wisdom.
Living beautifully.
Exactly. This is what wisdom leads us to.
Right.
So we need to employ the best possible way to call others towards Islam. We want to call out the first and foremost people whom we want to call towards Islam. And as the Quran says, "Qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara." Right. It's your children.
Right. If you want your children to grow up to become the imams of the society, to be the leaders of the society, it means that throughout the process of education, that when they're in your home and under your supervision, you bring them up to be strong believers of faith. And just the way that Allah instructs us to talk about followers of other faith, that, you know, جَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنُ, you have to use exactly the same technique with your own children.
Of course.
In transferring faith, iman, to your...
faith based on reasoning.
Right.
We don't want blind believers. We need people to have belief based on sound reasoning.
Right.
So we need to teach them to be able to be sound reasoners, whether it's in the realm of pure reasoning, whether it's in the realm of practical reasoning.
Right.
So we need to teach them and argue with them. So when we're indulging in this, when we're giving time to this, we need to be very careful. And all the time we are developing the way we reason with them. The arguments which we are presenting should be incremental. Every time we discuss with our children, they should be learning, whether for the child, whether for ourselves also.
Exactly. I just wanted to mention this point that oftentimes, we as parents need to empower ourselves first, because in this world with constant changes and challenges bombarding us from all directions, we need to strengthen our beliefs and we need to strengthen our reasoning and we need to study, learn constantly, be in touch with the ulama, go to Islamic centers, you know, always be in a never-stopping process of learning. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مطي الخيرات يا مطي الخيرات.
Regarding the saying of Allah the Exalted, أنفسكم وأهليكم نارا, save yourselves and your family from a fire. Imam Ali عليه السلام said, teach yourselves and your family righteousness.
يا مطي الخيرات يا
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We've been talking about the importance of talking logically to our children.
Yes, as you mentioned before the break, the very thing that is mentioned, utlubul ilma min al-mahdi ila al-lahd, it's not talking about formal learning, is it?
No.
It's talking about informal ways of learning, and the very discussions and arguments which you have with other people it's strengthening your own understanding, it's enhancing your understanding, so that is a continuous development of yourself and your child. It goes hand in hand. Every teacher, every guide learns more, in my opinion, learns more than the student.
Exactly. And as parents, when you're on your own, and if you're married, you don't have any children, you go in a monotonic way, you know, it's you, pretty much your spouse. But when you know that a little two eyes are watching you all the time, watches every move that you make, then you become really scared that, you know, what are you doing to that child? Which takes you back at what, how your thoughts are shaped, how your actions are teaching that little one. So parents, educate yourselves.
Exactly. So educate yourselves to be able to educate others, your children especially, because as a person who is a worthy, competent person, as a saleh person, of course, when you want to become an alim for a scholar or going to the society, you need to be a professional in doing so. But at home, you're not doing it for as a profession. You're doing it as a duty, as a responsibility. You need to learn to manage things in the best possible way. So you need to develop yourself and your children and to become models for them. And the learning has to continue. The argument has to be there. The argument shouldn't be a monologue. It should be a continuous development of a thought process. It shouldn't lead to conflict. It shouldn't lead to anger. We should agree to disagree. There's no problem in that.
Right. I think the foundation of having a good discussion or argument with your child is this love that we mentioned before. If the bond between the parent and child is not established based on love, then even if you're a philosopher, even if you are the most educated and revered scholar in any part of the world, but if there is no love between you and your child, it will go nowhere.
Exactly. And mind you, you need to take care of his level also.
كَلَّمْ النَّاسَ عَلَىٰ قَدْرِ عُقُولِهِمْ. Right.
You can't philosophize in a way that he can't understand or she can't understand.
Right.
You need to, you know, tone down your arguments also.
According to your addressee.
Yeah, exactly. So that is important. So we need to learn that. And the fourth thing is that transformational parents are themselves inspired parents. They want to learn, they want to grow, they want to go forward. They're always motivated. They're people who are becoming productive. They are productive members of society. There's no retirement for them.
Right. They're always full of ideas, innovations, newer techniques, always ready to justify and modify their techniques. If anywhere they see that their way or their behavior is not working, they think of learning new ways to cooperate and establish that bond between their children.
Exactly. It's because they themselves are productive. They are inspired. They want to be productive members of society. Their children also. The most challenging thing is today that technology is such that previously we were looking at the TV screen. We thought that the TV screen is everything that is there in the world. Mm-hmm. Now we're looking at a smaller thing in our palms. And we think the whole world is here.
What's the next step?
I mean, it's something...
Chips inside them are our minds.
Of course. I mean, you have holograms coming up, people coming up from all over the thousands of miles away, and you're looking at the hologram of a person
the
who's...
The virtual world.
It's all there. I mean, but still it's a tunnel vision. We're not allowing ourselves to go out of it. Technology is not allowing that. That is the problem with technology. It's not allowing you to think out of the box.
Right.
So we need to provide alternatives to our children.
You know, they said that modernism came to teach people that they shouldn't necessarily let religion to fix their mentality, but modernity itself taught people to learn and to think in a fixed way. This brings us to the end of another episode of our program, Islamic Upbringing. Thank you so much. I hope that our discussions were fruitful for you and you learned new information and new points. If you guys have any questions, feel free to write to us to our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Thank you so much. Take care of your beautiful souls and goodbye.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.